Hey, it's Steph Dixon, and welcome to the Live Wide Awake podcast. Thank you for being one of our listeners in over 88 countries around the world. Today, we're speaking with Fabian Cousteau, an aquanaut, oceanographic explorer, environmental advocate, and founder of the Fabian Cousteau Ocean Learning Center and the Proteus Ocean Group. As the first grandson of Jacques Cousteau, Fabian spent his early years aboard his famous grandfather's ships. He's well known for his study of sharks and was also an explorer at large for National Geographic. Having spent his life raising awareness, exploring, and educating the world through multiple mediums about the ocean, he is now building a space station for the ocean. In this conversation, we talk about how our natural resource bank account is going bankrupt, why we need to change our language, underwater exploration with the International Space Station for the ocean, and what our most precious resource is. I hope you enjoy this smooth conversation thanks to our sound partner, Audio Technica. Okay, it's time to live wide awake. Okay, well, Fabian, thank you so much. It's such an honor to be able to have you on the podcast and to be here in person with you in Singapore. It's so fun. Absolutely loved getting to know you a little bit more over the last few days and attending your talks. You are such an inspiration. And I'd really love to start with understanding a little bit about your early years, because obviously you have a very famous grandfather, Jacques Cousteau, and it sounds like a pretty unusual yet adventurous childhood. So what were your formative years like? Did you always know you wanted to have the ocean as your office?
Well, it's a pleasure being here. And I thank you for your patience, especially when I'm a bit jet lagged from being halfway around the world. The office, you know, I describe it as an office, but I never think of the ocean as an office. To me, it's home. It's always been home. And I've had the honor and privilege to grow up in and around the ocean. It's almost like a mother's womb in a sense. I feel a sense of calmness, a sense of kinship with the ocean part of our world. And because of that, and because of the perspective that I've seen over the years and the generations, and the changes that have happened in the ocean, the fact that the ocean has very few voices worldwide, it felt natural to try and be at least one of the voices for the animals and for the environment that otherwise doesn't get to speak up for itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what were some of the highlights and most challenging things you've had to do with this career or with this, I guess, love and passion that you have for the ocean?
Yeah, I think I could have probably chosen a much easier path to make a living. But, you know, passion is passion. It's hard to describe when you're have a, in this case, hopefully a healthy addiction. It would be easier to fundraise or to get investment dollars in something that is maybe more concrete, tangible, and simple, a building, an automobile, or, you know, something of that nature that most people are familiar with. But fundraising for ocean causes, fundraising for documentaries is always a difficult thing and has been regardless of what your last name is. In some cases, it's even a double-edged sword. It's a name that might bring in or open the door of recognition, but also has sometimes preconceived notions in terms of being able to fund these rather ambitious projects. So this is something we always struggle with, and one that I believe anyone who's in the ocean world does as well, or in the environmental world. We take things for granted, right? We take the environment, the air we breathe, the water we drink, the food that we eat, as if it were due us, when the reality is it has a cost, sometimes quantifiable, sometimes not. But what is the value of a breath of fresh air? Do we know that 60 to 80% of our oxygen in every breath that we take is generated by the ocean? A lot of these fairly simple concepts to oceanauts are very foreign to most people on the planet. And so education is also key in order for us to be able to advance the cause of investment in ocean-based projects. Mm.
And so you've touched on so many interesting things there, and I think the education part is huge. And however, at the same time, it's no secret that plastic is choking our water, temperatures and acidity are rising, many underwater species are facing or have faced extinction. Most people know at least one or two of these different things. Mm. And yet there's still this huge gap in the education that actually we cannot survive without the ocean. So why do you think we still have that huge gap? And I guess also, what do you think we can really do about it with the amount of technology and access to information people have right now? How have we not reached that point of understanding it.
Do we really know? Do we really feel what these things are all about? I question this because one of the big struggles is connecting people with the real urgency in a lot of these topics. Because in our daily lives, until something hits us in the face and we really struggle with it financially or health-wise or what have you, it's more conceptual than it is tangible reality. And unless you're a fisherman not being able to make a living anymore fishing, unless you're afflicted with the repercussions of endocrine disruptors, which are part of the microplastics that we ingest, which result oftentimes in learning and behavioral disabilities or cancer rates or what have you, it's easy to forget the challenges that we're facing today or ignore them intentionally or unintentionally. We're creatures, we're visual creatures, we're experiential creatures, we're tactile creatures. And as such, unless and until we have an emotional attachment to the information, you know, you mentioned plastics, for example, and most people see pictures of plastic or they'll see some on the beach. That's not even the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. Unfortunately, I've had the opportunity to go to the bottom of some of these oceans. And what you see at the surface is nothing compared to what we sometimes see at the bottom. And it's heartbreaking. But what does that have to do with the average person's daily life? And that's the story that really needs to hit home for people. Plastic, for example, we ingest about a credit card size worth of plastic every week. On average, during the year, in 12 months, the average person ingests about 210 grams of microplastics. And believe it or not, it's not just from eating sea life. It's from drinking beer. It's from tap water. It's from bottled water. It's the vehicles have been there for us to ingest our own garbage. It's just we're not cognizant of it because we don't see it until it's, of course, too late, until it has health repercussions.
And so that sounds quite dire in a way, you know, it's literally in our tap water and our beer, as you said. So what do you suggest that we do to actually raise this awareness and help people to connect emotionally, as you said?
I don't mean to sound so depressing.
We'll get to the hopeful stuff as well. Don't worry.
But some of the situations are dire, right? We've ignored the problems for far too long, for too many generations. And now we're seeing the very real repercussions of using our oceans as an endless resource in a garbage can. We've lost about 60% of our world's wild fish stocks because we've overfished and in ways that are completely unsustainable, you know, basically clear-cutting the oceans. Why is it that we're still hunter-gatherers in the sea when we've been farmers on land for over 10,000 years? And now we have the tools and we have some of the knowledge to become much more in balance with our life support system and our natural resource bank account. Why is it that we're not implementing a lot of these approaches that would allow for us to have a much more symbiotic relationship with this little blue oasis in space? You know, there's a lot of public knowledge that needs to happen. And more importantly than that, touching people emotionally, because as emotional creatures, that really motivates us, giving a sense of urgency as well as a sense of hope. And to motivate the decision makers who make decisions on our behalf, be it government, be it businesses. We have to remember as consumers, we are the ultimate vote takers, right? And to encourage a business, I won't name specific ones just because it's not fair. We're all culpable of mistakes. But to be able to motivate the businesses we solicit in our everyday lives, in our consumption, to do better for us by saying, hey, listen, I'd like to continue coming to this restaurant or I'd like to continue buying this product or service. But the only way I'll do that is if you look at a better practice, more efficient practice, one that gives back to our planet or invests in restoring some of the damage we've done in the past. We'll never get out of our cycle. And I, for one, don't accept that reality because I want to be able to give back to my future generations, right? My daughter, et cetera. What we and our ancestors have taken for granted, which is a healthy planet and one that we're proud to live in and are awed by its wonders. So we need to reinvest in that bank account, that natural resource bank account, because at the end of the day, it's about self-preservation, you know, if nothing else. Human beings tend to be selfish creatures. We care about us. We care maybe about our family and our community. And in order for us to ensure a healthy future for them, then we must by default be conservationists and concerned about our environment and the sentient beings we share the planet with.
Yeah, and it's such an important point to underline, because people always talk about saving the planet, but it's not the planet that needs saving. It's us as a species that's really in jeopardy here. And so what, zooming out a little bit, do you think are some of the key levers that we should really be focusing on? Whether that's, you mentioned obviously our power as consumers, but what about from a government or business perspective? Because I love your analogy of the fact that we are going bankrupt with our natural resource bank. And I think that's super clear. And so, yeah, where should we really be focusing attention, and how can we play a bigger part and be those conservationists that you're encouraging us to be?
And let's remember that if we go bankrupt with our natural resource bank account, there is no bailout loan. And although we'll take a lot of the biodiversity with us, at the end of the day, it's really to our own detriment. In a million years, 100 million years, the planet will be just fine. And honestly, nature doesn't care what our political affiliations are, what our thoughts and opinions are. It's just based on science. It's very easy to be overwhelmed with the bad news. It's very easy to ignore it intentionally because it's bad news and you feel powerless to do anything against such a tidal wave. But we have to remember that we got here by our everyday decisions as individuals. And so the best way to approach the solution is by modifying our everyday decisions. And that's also a very encouraging prospect, because that's the most impactful way that as an individual, one can make a positive change. And it's not just about recycling plastics and things like that, which of course always helps, or beach cleanups and everything else. It's really about changing our thought process in fundamental ways by changing, for example, our language. There is no such thing as throwing something away, for example. Right? There is no way. This is a closed loop system. It's a little bubble, and we depend on it for everything that we cherish and love and so on and so forth. Enjoy. We talk about things like seafood, which irritates me because it objectifies with almost a valueless nature what the objects of our desires are in the sea. And if we only shifted it just a little bit and started calling it sea life, intellectually, we give it a value. And by giving it a value on a more concrete level, we might actually give it a value in the spreadsheets, right? In the spreadsheets of costs versus benefits when industrial trawlers go out there, or if you're eating a piece of sea life on your plate, and all of a sudden you have a more emotional attachment to that thing. Of course, you know, eating lower down the food chain and all that's always more beneficial, but just the ability to appreciate what we have in front of us, be it a beach, be it a bunch of clams in a plate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, gives us a tool that we just simply haven't been using before, which is a connection with the ocean. You know, we talk very concretely in circles like the United Nations or COP or what have you about the value, the tangible value of ocean, or at least the calculable value of ocean right now. And, you know, estimates of $24 trillion per annum, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Personally, it doesn't make sense to me because we know very little about the ocean. We're not putting into account all the value that it gives us. So it's a gross underestimate. We don't look at the intangibles, for example. I mentioned earlier, every other breath that we take or more is thanks to the ocean. Oh, what value is that? The water that's generated by the climate, that's thanks to the ocean, right? By precipitation and so on, thanks to the ocean. Okay, clean glass of water. How much is that worth to you? It's worth life. How much is that worth? You know, and so on and so forth. And those are, of course, very, very basic examples. So what's the emotional value of going to vacation on a beach and being able to dig your toes into clean sand and watching a sunset over the horizon of the ocean? How much is that worth? You know, so it's really difficult to put a monetary value, which is something we're based on as a global culture, on our life support system. Yet, And hopefully through documentaries and through these conferences, we're able to motivate people to start thinking this way, to start looking at ocean conservation, not as a cost, but as an investment in our future.
Absolutely. And so on the conservation piece, like, how do you think conservation is doing right now? And what needs to shift so that we have that focus, that understanding, and the right amount of capital that's actually going to be able to help us preserve what needs to happen?
Well, to be perfectly honest, there were a couple of decades not so long ago that I was losing hope that we could change our course, turn the tide of our past actions and our present actions. I'm, in the last few years, been much more encouraged and much more hopeful and excited about the current generations, especially with the wealth of knowledge that are at our fingertips, quite literally, and the ability to motivate people in short order because of our global networking capabilities. Now people really are getting into a state of mind of understanding and concern that's not about alarm necessarily, although that's certainly part of it, but about motivation. And it's not a, oh, that's another generation's problem, or, oh, that's somewhere else, but let's do something and let's do something now. For me, seeing it over my lifespan and a three generational lifespan in our family, this is probably the most hopeful time in the last 30, 40 years. And I'm not saying hope so tritely because, you know, hope can very easily be misinterpreted. Yes, we're in trouble. Yes, we have a lot of challenges ahead of us. And yes, we will continue to see loss for a good while now. But now people are motivated. People are getting into the action part of things, changing behaviors, changing perspectives, consuming more carefully. And conservation is starting to gain traction. And that's really important. That's essential. So on that level, we're seeing more, not just more attention, but also more investment in conservation efforts. Not nearly enough, but we're slowly getting there. And that to me is extraordinarily encouraging.
That's good. I mean, I'm happy to hear that after, you know, three generations of ocean explorers and conservationists that you are the most hopeful right now. I think that gives me more hope as well that we're moving in the right direction. And so something really fascinating that you shared is that to date, despite all of modern day ocean exploration, we've explored less than 7% of the entire ocean. How is that even possible?
Yeah. I think I'm probably overestimating by saying 7%. It's more like 5%, I'm guessing. How is that possible? Because you're talking about 99% of our world's living space, right? I mean, we're used to thinking of the perspective of ocean, at least this is in the old days, what was taught in school is, well, 72 or 73% of the world's surface is ocean, blah, blah, blah. Well, first of all, we're not talking about two dimensions here. We're talking about three dimensions. So talking about three dimensions, the ocean's 99% of our world's living space, within which over 90% of our world's biodiversity lives and thrives. 3.4 billion cubic kilometers of volume, which has an average depth of 7,000 meters, and things like areas like the Marianas Trench are well deeper than that. So there are a lot of technological challenges and physiological challenges to getting to those parts of the ocean. Yes, we are mapping the ocean, but from a distance, like saying that you know what's happening from satellites. Yes, satellites are very useful, but there's no such substitute as actually going there yourself, right? So I'm all about the human technological interface to explore the ocean much, much more. And it gives us tremendous opportunities to discover all sorts of things. Let's remember, the ocean is a chemical soup, right? So even if we're looking at things as seemingly basic as biochemistry is actually very complicated, but we have opportunities to make discoveries that are potentially groundbreaking. Cures for cancer or pandemics or what have you can be at our fingertips if we just spend more time in the ocean studying it and understanding and learning from it. Storm mitigation, right? I mean, we have fairly decent weather predictors right now, but we're missing a whole part of our weather models because we aren't in the ocean. The ocean is our barometer, right? It's what regulates our weather patterns. And so as climate change related issues roll forward, climate gets more and more erratic. So we need to be on top of things to mitigate damages from storm surges and potential life loss from storm surges. The better we can predict those things, the more benefit it is to us, as well, of course, as the planet. So I'm really excited about the future of ocean exploration, leveraging new technologies, as well as being able to build platforms to stay longer and go deeper and further into the ocean.
Yeah, and this is exactly what you're doing. So I'd love for you to share a little bit more about your project Proteus. Am I saying that correctly? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how you're really going to be taking not only the technology, but exploration to the next level.
Yeah. So anyone who's been a scuba diver may identify with my biggest frustration as a scuba diver. I've been scuba diving from the ripe old age of 4 years old. The disclaimer there is that's not something I would encourage. Patty's certification, and now he's certified, I think he's 11 or 12 years old now. But despite that, it gave me a love for the ocean. And I would encourage people to at least peek below the blue veneer once in their lifetimes. And one of my biggest frustrations as a scuba diver is the limit of time in this wonder world, in this alien landscape, this fireworks display of life. You know, and submersibles are fantastic. AUVs are awesome, autonomous underwater vehicles. But there's a lack of tangibility and control in both those. And these are all different tools. And one of the biggest tools that we're missing, or the hammer or the screwdriver in our toolbox, is a platform that allows for human beings to stay underwater for not minutes or hours, but weeks, months, possibly longer. And Proteus is basically, in its most simple definition, slated to be the International Space Station of the ocean, right? So imagine the space station at the bottom of the ocean where you can house 12 to 18 people for weeks and months so that they can complete their missions, they complete their tasks, their studies, their science, to look for new forms of life, to study the microplastics issue or the biochemistry of a coral, or to look at hydrocarbon pollution, to look at acidification issues and see how we can mitigate that, or to create new technologies to scrub out all that excess CO2 from the absorbed CO2, man-made CO2 that the oxygen does to the tune, I think, of 30 to 50%. The only way we can do that and leverage the coefficiency of time is by building an underwater platform that allows for us to live and work underwater for those extended periods of time. So to me, it's just perfectly logical to build underwater stations that allow for certain creature comforts like at home, but also gives us all the tools like our businesses to be able to go to that final frontier and explore that final frontier in a way that enhances the network of other tools so that we can bring about that big data, share it with the world, and create new businesses, new technologies, new approaches so that we can live and understand our life support system in a way that allows for us to appreciate it, to honor it, and to honor the future well-being of our species and others.
So exciting. I love the analogy or the comparison, I guess, to the space station for the ocean. I think that's just crazy clear. And also just, you know, it just talks about how frontier this really is. And so do you already know where your first station is going to be and what some of the first kind of projects are going to happen? Like, get us more excited.
Yeah. I mean, the biggest frustration is I'm a very impatient person. And, you know, big ideas are always slow to get off the ground. And everyone gets, oh, yeah, International Space Station. I get it. Right? I mean, it's pretty obvious. Like most of the time I hear from scientists and just anyone who listens, like, why haven't we done this before? Well, to be perfectly clear, this is in some ways a proven platform on a much smaller scale. My grandfather built some of the first underwater habitats for scientific research and just experimentation, human physiology and all that sort of thing. Conchelf series of habitats. And the US Navy's done it. The Italians have done a couple of things and the Germans and so on and so on. But they were always purpose-built for a short amount of time and then they'd pull them out of the ocean, either because of funding, because of whatever. We're building on the shoulders of pioneers. And in this particular case, we're addressing all the shortcomings and frustrations of the previous generations. Lack of tools, lack of ability to stay down longer, lack of knowledge, and so on and so forth. And also the understanding and the need in today's world to be able to have that platform that's not only for advanced research, and then incorporates all the most modern technologies to be modular to the approaches to be able to cater to the next 10, 20, 30 years of ocean exploration in a way that keeps up with technology and needs and demands, but also allows for us for the very first time to have a broadcast studio live at the bottom of the sea. So you can share these things, these discoveries, these wow moments, these concerns, et cetera, with the world, right? That was never afforded before. So built integrally into the infrastructure is a communication platform. So we can inspire the next generation to dream, to become aquanauts. I'm all for astronauts and space exploration. Yay. Sign me up if we have a round trip ticket to the oceans of Mars and beyond. But until that time, 7.8 billion and growing are dependent on our little oasis in space. So it stands to reason we should probably explore more than 5% of that life support system.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing. I think it's really exciting. And I love the communication aspect and just how this really will, exactly as you said, be able to inspire a whole new generation to want to explore and to be those explorers and, you know, innovate on everything that you're building. So I think it's really exciting for the future. I wanted to just circle back a little bit and just, you know, because we're coming to the end of our conversation, but you talked a little bit about going into the darkness. It's what I call it anyway, like, you know, losing that hope, maybe feeling anxious, maybe feeling jaded, you know, all of those things. Mm. What was it, or did you have any tools or any things that you were able to focus on that really gave you that hope in the sea of darkness?
Yeah. A lot of drinking. No, yeah, that doesn't help. I've tried that before. There are a lot of times that it's easy to lose hope because we have a lot of challenges. And having seen the world change so much just in my lifetime, in the decades that I've been scuba diving, you know, what really recharges my batteries is talking to young people, talking to kids, talking to teenagers, talking to people who, human beings, who haven't built the walls, the restraints of their life yet, and don't use barriers to use words like impossible. Which I don't believe in. Human beings are capable of miracles if they're pressed to task, right? And there's no better example of that than, you know, staring into the eyes of a child and talking about the ocean, you know, their curiosity, their boundless enthusiasm, their creativity and approach, which we've forgotten as adults. Oftentimes I'll get inspiration from that in new solution building, because when you pose a problem to a child, they have a very different approach and mindset than adult does. And it's all about, well, let's get it done. Let's fix it. So to me, you know, that's the biggest recharge. It's light at the end of the tunnel. And I've noticed that if you approach it the right way, even adults can re-spark that. And some of the most creative adults, some of the most impactful adults, as well as children, are the ones that create the biggest change within the darkness. And we can do it. You know, time is always against us. We're still in a tailspin, but we can right our way and start rowing in the same direction. Because at the end of the day, we're all in the proverbial same boat. It doesn't matter what class you're in. It doesn't matter what gender, doesn't matter what political affiliation, it's affecting us all in the same way. So it behooves us all to start pitching in.
Absolutely. I love that. Thank you for sharing. I think it's great to have that different mindset and to tap back into what it was like as children or spend time with children, as you said. So I think that's a really beautiful way to find light in the darkness. How do you think that we can live wide awake?
Even, you know, CEOs have kids too, right? How can we live awake? Very simply, let's look at our most precious resource, time. I don't know, and it doesn't really matter whether you're a religious person, atheist, whatever you believe in. Factually speaking, what we do know is we have a certain amount of time on this planet, each and every one of us, and we don't know how much of it we have. And to me, it's a shame to squander any of that precious time, because it's the best gift we have. To spend time with our families or friends, to spend time creating positive change. And you can do that by making, as well as making a living and so on and so forth. But to me, what satisfies my inner soul is to know that I've made the best of the time on this planet. And hopefully everyone thinks that way.
Beautiful way to end our conversation. Fabian, thank you so much for your time and everything that you're doing for humanity. I'm so excited to continue following along with your journey. And yeah, very inspired. Thank you.
My very best to all of you. It's been a pleasure being on your podcast. I think I'd like to share a very easy, simple thought that my grandfather passed on to me, which was people protect what they love. They love what they understand. They understand what they learn. So with that, thank you all very much. Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Thank you. Three things I'm taking away from this conversation with Fabian. Firstly, we're going bankrupt with our natural resource bank account, and there's not going to be any bailout. We got here by our everyday decisions, and the best way to get out of the situation is to modify our everyday actions. Secondly, we need to change our language. There's no such thing as throwing something away. Everything is still here in some form or another. And instead of seafood, we should call it and look at it as sea life. Thirdly, time is our very best and biggest gift, so let's make the most of what we have on this planet. People protect what they love what they understand, and they understand what they learn. I'm curious, what did you think about the episode, and what were your main takeaways? Is there a topic you want me to dive deeper into? I'd love to hear from you. You can find me at Stephel Dixon or at Live Wide Awake. If you got something out of the podcast and you want to continue this journey with us, consider subscribing and supporting. I hope that today's conversation stirred something deep within you, ready to awaken. And until next time, live wide awake.